there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Due to the graphic nature of this murder case, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
Cheryl, I'm here. Oh, Mama.
We have to help him.
Is he?
I don't know, dear. I don't know. Oh, I don't know what to do. Maybe some cold cloths.
Okay, where are they?
I'm not sure. Look in the hall closet or my bathroom.
He was just saying such dreadful things. I was so scared.
I know, Cheryl. Just go.
What's going to happen?
Nothing. Nothing is going to happen. The doctor will be here in a minute, and he's going to make him well.
But what if he can't?
He will. He has to. Johnny! John! Cheryl, go now!
Daddy!
Cheryl? Cheryl, honey? What's wrong? What happened?
It's terrible. You've got to get over here, fast!
Is your mother there?
Yes.
Can you put her on the phone?
Cheryl! Cheryl! Where are you?
Just get here quick, Daddy. Please.
Welcome to Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Wendy McKenzie.
Today, we're continuing our investigation into the murder of Johnny Stompanato,
a mobster and enforcer for the notorious Mickey Cohen.
Well, the official story is that Stompanato was stabbed to death by Cheryl Crane, his girlfriend's 14-year-old daughter.
And it just so happened that his girlfriend was Lana Turner, blonde bombshell and certifiable Hollywood legend.
But is that version of the story really what happened?
It's a story so sensational, it sounds more like the plot of a Hollywood movie than a true crime story.
Could a teenage girl really take down a grown man?
A hardened criminal with a history of violence, no less, caught in a blind rage, terrorizing the girl and her mother.
On today's investigation, we'll try to get to the bottom of what really happened.
This is Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. You're listening to our final episode on the murder of Johnny Stompanato. If you want to hear our investigation into other cold cases, you can listen, subscribe, and write reviews on your favorite podcast directory. You can also listen through our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. I'm your host, Wendy McKenzie.
And I'm your other host, Carter Roy. Now, back to the details of the Stompanato case.
The murder occurred on the night of Good Friday, April 4th, 1958.
On Easter Sunday, newspapers nationwide were splashed with the sensational news.
Lana Turner's girl kills mother's suitor.
Man stabbed to death at Lana Turner's home.
Lana Turner's girl kills Cohen's pal.
The headlines were everywhere, accompanied by gruesome photos from the crime scene in Lana's bedroom.
For Lana, who dreaded bad press, the whole thing was a living nightmare.
Lana wanted to ensure that Cheryl behaved perfectly in the wake of the murder,
which meant no special treatment throughout the legal proceedings.
The fear that she might come off looking like a spoiled Hollywood brat.
And that might hurt her credibility.
Whose?
Well, Technically, both Cheryl's and Lana's, because the mother-daughter team made some missteps immediately following the stabbing and ended up complicating matters.
First and foremost, they waited to call the police, and that's never a smart move if you're trying to avoid suspicion.
Immediately after the murder, Cheryl called her father, restaurateur Stephen Crane.
Without telling Lana.
The first person Lana called was her mother.
And her mother called for a doctor, who called for a second doctor, and an ambulance.
How is he? Is he breathing? Why did he stop making noise?
I can't get a heartbeat.
Oh, no.
Call Mr. Jerry Giesler.
Stompanato was dead on sight.
And Jerry Giesler was the best criminal defense attorney around. He was the golden age equivalent to celebrity lawyers like Mark Garagos and Gloria Allred today.
In the late 1950s, "Get me Giesler" was a favorite punchline among industry insiders.
Short and chubby, with a high-pitched voice, Jerry Giesler wasn't exactly what you might picture when you hear celebrity lawyer.
But he successfully defended Charlie Chaplin and Errol Flynn on rape charges.
And represented Marilyn Monroe during her divorce from Joe DiMaggio.
He even defended mobsters like Bugsy Siegel and Mickey Cohen. We talked about Mickey a bit in the last episode, but it'll be important to remember that he and Giesler knew each other later on in this case.
Whenever a newspaper snapped a photo of a celebrity leaving the courtroom scot-free, more often than not, Jerry Giesler was right there beside them.
When you combine studio clout and legal expertise, Giesler always seemed to win.
His specialty was defending clients who had committed crimes of passion, whether or not they were actually guilty of the crime.
My clients don't want justice. They want off.
And Jerry was more than willing to oblige, for a hefty price.
Giesler didn't have a perfect record, but losses were rare. Of the more than 70 murder cases Giesler tried, not a single defendant was ever executed.
Knowing Giesler's reputation, Lana trusted that she and Cheryl were in good hands.
When Giesler arrived at 730 North Bedford Drive, the police had arrived.
So, after the murder, the guests, in order of arrival, were Stephen Crane, Lana's mother, two doctors, emergency workers, police, and Jerry Giesler.
Well, that's quite a party.
It is a lot of people to have trudging around an active crime scene.
So the scene was compromised.
Potentially, but not necessarily.
When police arrived, they found Stompanato's body sprawled on the floor of Lana's bedroom.
Well, there was very little blood, reportedly only as much as 3 dime-sized spots. But he had a hole in his sweater and t-shirt, and a gaping wound in the upper part of his abdomen.
That doesn't sound right for a fatal stab wound.
It's unusual, but not unheard of. With puncture wounds, there can still be internal bleeding.
The murder weapon, a 10-inch butcher's knife, was found on the sink in Lana's bathroom.
Why'd they move the knife?
What difference does it make? Clearly the kid did it. She said so herself. Did you see her? She's white as a sheet and shaking like a leaf.
Kids will say anything, especially if they're scared out of their wits because they just watched you commit murder.
What are you getting at?
I'm just saying, I've seen Lana's movies.
For Christ's sakes, Frank, they're movies. Make pretend.
I'm just saying, I know what a dangerous woman looks like, and Lana's made a career out of it.
I guess we should go after Jimmy Cagney for being a mobster. Or better yet, Bela Lugosi for being Dracula. You're a real blockhead, you know that?
Some questioning happened at the scene, but theories started flying almost immediately.
By the time the chief got there, Lana was hysterical.
Mrs. Turner, I'm Clint Anderson, chief of police.
Can't I take the blame for this horrible thing?
No, not unless you committed the crime. We'll find out all of the facts.
Well, that's pretty rich, considering what we've learned about the LAPD in other investigations of the time.
The idea that Lana wanted to take the blame for Johnny's murder has been reported in several places.
It's a noble idea, the mother taking the fall for the daughter, but as the chief said, it just wasn't possible unless there was reason to believe that she actually did it.
Incidentally, that precise series of events mirrors the plot of Mildred Pierce, a popular film noir starring Joan Crawford that had come out in 1945.
In that movie, Crawford's character tries to take the blame when her daughter murders the mother's boyfriend, with whom she had been having an affair.
Were Cheryl and Johnny having an affair?
Well, stranger things have happened, but we'll get into that a little later. There's no real connection to that movie and the Stompinato case, but it's safe to say that one of the reasons the theory became popular was because it was already out there in the zeitgeist.
Conversely, when people started floating the rumor that Lana might have done it, it spread like wildfire.
The truth is that the only people who saw what happened were Lana, Cheryl, and Johnny. With Johnny dead, it would be easy for Lana and Cheryl to spin the story to their best advantage, whatever that may be.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
And now let's continue the story.
The rumor that Lana Turner did it gained traction when it was championed by another famous figure, none other than Johnny's boss, Mickey Cohen.
Now, what do you picture of when you think of an old school gangster?
Big fedora, 5 o'clock shadow, chomping on a cigar.
That was Mickey to a T.
He was one of the legendary West Coast mob bosses.
The movie Gangster Squad is actually based on him. In the 1950s, the LAPD really did establish an elite gangster squad of vice cops tasked with rooting out corruption and taking down organized crime.
But Mickey, the incredibly successful boss behind it all, was a darling with celebrities, the press, and the public.
They saw him as shady, but entertaining.
He talked out of the side of his mouth, and he liked to take his bulldog, Mickey Jr., out to dinner.
That's it. That's it. Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy?
Sir, may I bring you anything else?
I'm good. Bring out another meatball for my buddy here.
He didn't drink, and the cigar he kept in his mouth was rarely lit.
People saw him as a harmless gambler who happened to run with a rough crowd, a lovable scamp.
And a winner. He was good at his job, and everyone knew it.
It's amazing what people are willing to let slide when a guy's got charisma.
In reality, Mickey was an explosively hot-tempered, trigger-happy thug whose motto was anything to make a buck.
He had a rap sheet that could stretch from here to the moon. Starting at the tender age of 7, he assaulted a cop with a hot plate when they caught him red-handed operating the still of the family bootlegging operation.
At 9, he held up a movie theater box office with a baseball bat.
He got away with the money, but the cops caught him almost immediately. He had a lot to learn.
And he learned from the best.
As a young man, Mickey boxed professionally and worked for both the Italian and the Jewish gang bosses in the Midwest and the East Coast.
He ran with the biggest players, Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, and Bugsy Siegel.
In fact, when Bugsy started to get out of line and the mob supposedly had him whacked, Mickey took his place to run the show in Los Angeles.
As you might remember, we covered the details of the Bugsy Siegel murder in previous episodes.
He was the guy who went $5 million over budget building the Flamingo in Las Vegas. If you haven't heard that one yet, definitely check it out.
Well, by the time Mickey hired Johnny Stompinato as his muscle, he was a full-blown kingpin.
When one of his numerous contacts let him know about Stompinato's untimely demise, Mickey raced over to Lana's house,
where he was intercepted by his old pal, Jerry Giesler.
You can't be here, Mickey.
Says who?
Says me. What do you want to be spotted at a murder scene for? You had nothing to do with this one. Where's your head?
What happened? She got him, didn't she? I knew she was gunning for him.
Look, I know Johnny was one of your guys.
He was more than that. He was my brother. He was like a kid brother to me. Where's Lana?
Oh, no, no, no. If Lana sees you, she's going to fall apart altogether. Do me a favor. Get yourself down to the morgue. You can say your goodbyes there.
Mickey left for the morgue, and Lana and Cheryl made the trip to the Beverly Hills police station,
where Cheryl gave her official statement to the police.
Really, officer? Are handcuffs necessary? She's just a girl.
You agreed, Lana. No special treatment. Handcuffs are part of the deal.
It's all right, Mother. I'm ready, officer.
Calling our attention to what happened this evening, we would like you to tell us exactly what happened. Was it a dispute between Mr. Stompinato and your mother?
Yes.
What was said?
It was about age. Mother found out he was 10 years younger than he said he was.
Was an argument had over that?
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
Well, they had an argument. Then he was threatening Mother.
How?
Well, to kill her and to hurt Daddy, Granny, and me.
He threatened to hurt all of you?
Yes.
How?
He said he has ways of doing it.
Where was this argument taking place?
First in my bedroom, and then in Mother's room.
In the bedroom where his body was found?
Yes.
Did you go downstairs to pick up the knife from the kitchen?
Yes.
Will you explain the circumstances leading up to the incident that occurred tonight?
Well, Mother and John were arguing and she was crying. I could not hear exactly what they were saying. Mother told me he threatened her and would kill her if she tried to leave him, and she was afraid and I wanted her to call and get some protection. She was very afraid and she just told me about all the times he threatened her. He said he would sit back and watch all that happened, and he was laughing.
Then you went downstairs to the kitchen?
I did that before.
When did you get the knife?
Before they went into Mother's room.
Then you took it into your room?
Yes, in case he tried to hurt Mother.
You thought your mother's life was in danger?
He kept threatening her, and I thought he was going to hurt her, so I rushed into the room and struck him with the knife. He screamed and asked me what I was doing. I ran out of the room. Mother called me back and said to help her. Finally, I came back. I called Daddy before I went back in the first time and told him to come over fast.
Down at the morgue, the press was getting an alternative side of the story.
Mickey ID'd Johnny's body for the deputy coroner, then immediately gave a statement to the rabid journalists by the door.
I can't understand it. I thought she liked him very much. We were happy, Cheryl and Johnny and me. We used to go horseback riding together. The fact of the matter is that I just don't buy it.
What do you think happened, Mickey?
Well, I hate to speculate. Pointing fingers and all is serious business. But I'm saying that if it's between the girl and her mother, well, we all know what kind of woman Lana Turner is.
Are you saying you think Lana did it?
I ain't saying nothing. I'm just wondering how a little girl takes down a full-grown man. Did you know Johnny was a Marine? With a kitchen knife, no less. It's too much.
Can you give us a quote, Mickey?
I don't like the whole thing. There's lots of unanswered questions. I'm gonna find some of those answers no matter what happens.
The next day, papers ran with headlines like, Lana fears Cohen gang vengeance.
Did she think she was going to get whacked?
It's possible. But it's more likely that Lana feared that Mickey would destroy whatever was left of her good reputation.
What was really strange was Mickey's sudden righteous turn.
Sure. He and Johnny had been close, and presumably there had been some friendly affection between them. But what prompted this sudden crusade for justice?
Well, it's hard to say anything for sure about Mickey, but one thing you can bet on, he always had an angle going.
Well, wherever he was headed, he was going on his own, because Mickey was virtually alone in his disbelief.
Neither prosecutors nor the public appeared distressed over Stompanato's death.
Oh, come on, Mickey, give it a rest. Why drag the kid into it?
Because she took out one of my guys. She stole from me. I should sue her for damages and emotional distress. He was a very dear friend of mine.
You don't have any friends, Mickey. You've got business associates.
Tomato, tomato. That's a very cruel thing to say, Jerry. I've got loads of friends. I used to count you among them.
Friends don't charge retainer fees.
They would if they were smart.
Cheryl spent the weekend in jail, and Monday morning, the L.A. County D.A., William B. McKesson, held a press conference.
I want to emphasize that this case will receive no special treatment. We will proceed to investigate the matter, and if necessary, to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law.
Mr. McKesson! Mr. McKesson!
Cheryl was brought before a probate judge for a pre-detention hearing.
All sides were permitted to address the court.
Order!
Your Honor, I can prove Stompanato's death was justifiable homicide and ask that Miss Crane be released to her grandmother's custody.
Your Honor, I'm going to advise that Miss Turner not be released on bail. There are undoubtedly mafia connections to this case, and I think we would all hate to see Miss Crane pressured one way or another by either this criminal element or her mother, Miss Lana Turner.
Mr. Giesler, Mr. McKesson. I have heard your statements and hereby order that Miss Crane be detained until such time as we can determine our next course of action.
Cheryl was taken from the Beverly Hills Jail to the county juvenile hall until they decided what to do next.
Chief Anderson suggested they take the matter to trial.
I am satisfied that Stompanato was killed with a knife and we have the party who did it.
Still, there was no talk of criminal charges. Cheryl was being held as a material witness, an adjudicated juvenile, rather than a suspect.
Well, Lana must have been going crazy.
Wouldn't you?
Well, the judge further ordered, against the will of the police and the DA, that a coroner's inquest be held to determine whether or not a crime had even been committed.
In a coroner's inquest, the coroner selects a jury to examine the circumstances surrounding a suspicious death and renders a verdict.
The verdict can identify the person responsible or assign blame to negligent parties.
Lana?
Potentially. They can also determine if a matter requires further investigation.
So it's like an indictment?
Not exactly. In a grand jury indictment, the verdict is binding. With an inquest, law enforcement officials can choose whether or not they want to continue with the charges.
Well, so what's the point?
An inquest can be helpful because it formally establishes things like cause of death and what, if any, elements of the incident will be considered criminal.
Well, that makes sense.
Well, it also gives prosecutors a chance to see how certain pieces of evidence affect jurors.
Oh, like a dress rehearsal.
Exactly. Inquests have fallen out of favor in recent years, but in the 1950s, they were routinely called for following fatal police shootings. They were generally public and often dramatic.
The inquest was meant to give a speedy and transparent airing, often on live television, as was the case with Cheryl, of the circumstances surrounding a death and to render a verdict either accidental, justifiable, or criminal homicide.
And although not legally binding, the verdict of the inquest generally put the matter to bed.
So everyone could put the incident behind them quickly.
Which can either be good or bad, depending on how things play out.
Cheryl's inquest was scheduled for 1 week later.
And the press was all over it. It was broadcast live throughout the country.
And papers ran the full transcript of the proceedings.
Lana's dirty laundry was out there for the world to see.
Oh, Mama, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry, darling. It'll all be over soon.
But that was still enough time for Mickey to do some damage.
A few days later, an unmarked package arrived at Jerry Giesler's office. The legal team took it straight to Lana.
Lana!
Jerry, what is it? Your assistant said it was urgent. Did you find a way to keep the press out of the inquest?
I'm afraid this is something else entirely. Got these this afternoon.
Oh, no.
Do you have any idea when they were taken?
Well, as you can clearly see, these negatives depict me asleep, so no, I can't say that I do have any memory of their being taken. Gee, this is just what I need. Just when I think all of that sweater girl nonsense is behind me. There's gonna be shots of this old bag of bones strewn across every paper, naked as a jaybird.
Don't be so down on yourself. You still look...
Jerry, attempt to maintain a veneer of professionalism.
I'm sorry, Lana. Was it Johnny?
It must have been. That dirty dog. How did you get them?
The package was sent anonymously, but this is exactly the sort of thing we've seen from Mickey Cohen in the past.
He was going to blackmail me.
That was our line of thinking. With a few darkroom tricks, he could make these images look a lot less innocent than just sleeping in the nude.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
Photoshopping without a computer.
Exactly. Lana didn't need to hear any more than that.
She and the lawyers burned the negatives and flushed the ashes down the toilet.
The truth is that blackmail was Mickey's plan all along. He knew Johnny's specialty was charming rich older women into giving him money, so Mickey gave Johnny an assignment. Woo Lana, then force her to make Stompanato a producer.
And just a gigolo,
gigolo.
Everywhere I go,
gigolo.
People
gigolo.
Know the power
gigolo.
And voila, Mickey could add moving pictures to his list of entrepreneurial endeavors.
That explains Mickey's vested interest in Lana's affairs.
With Johnny out of the picture, Mickey had to resort to Plan B. But he wasn't about to give up on getting the most out of Lana.
Well, the blackmail plan hadn't worked, but Mickey knew that Johnny had held on to the love letters he and Lana had sent to each other.
Hours after the murder, Cohen sent one of his men to break into Johnny's apartment to steal the letters.
Then he leaked them to the press.
The Los Angeles Herald Examiner was the first to break the story, and 2 days before the inquest, printed every word of the letters between Lana and Johnny.
The letters provided an intimate look at Lana and Johnny's relationship. From steamy early letters to talking of their love, their hopes, dreams, and sex, and longings. When the letter dated January 5th at 10:45 p.m., Lana wrote,
"Today started with a letter to you, and as this day, as dull and lonely as it was, is closing, I find I'm drawn to writing you once more."
In the spring, things had taken a less romantic turn as Lana pleaded for space.
Darling, please, after our ball, I've been thinking and thinking. Yes, what a shocking thrill it would be to see you on the plane or wherever, but this is not right. You must let me be alone in my own world for a while, to rest, think,
rest think. I fully realize now that you feel there will never be a difference. I don't yet. That is why I need the tie and a different place to funnel through all the emotional turmoil I've been through.
Never the shameless showman, Cohen freely admitted to leaking the letters.
I thought it was fair to show that Johnny wasn't exactly unwelcome company, like Lana said.
Among the letters were also messages from Cheryl to Johnny, which, as you might imagine, were damaging to her defense.
Well, this was not a girl writing to a man she feared. It was a teenager exchanging pleasantries with her mother's boyfriend, telling him about her day and filling him in on the latest high school gossip.
Have you been doing any water skiing lately? Please do and think of me. I love it. When are you all coming back? Soon, I hope.
It sounds like they were really close.
Which, when you consider the larger context, makes the situation that much more tragic for Cheryl.
Mickey had hoped that the love letters would hurt Lana's reputation, but they actually had the opposite of their intended effect.
The public didn't see the infatuated lovers Mickey hoped they would.
In fact, they saw Lana's requests for space as a symptom of Johnny's increasing abuse and evidence the affair was slowing down.
The theft and publication of the letters came off as unseemly.
As the inquest began, rumors continued to circulate. But for the most part, the public sided with Lana.
Did you see the Lana Turner letters in the paper?
Of course I did. I read every word, and I know you did too.
You know me too well. I must admit I felt a bit wicked with how much I was enjoying the drama of it all.
The Hearst Company couldn't have asked for a better story.
I do think they went a little too far with printing the letters, though.
I had precisely the same reaction.
It's not poor Lana's fault her daughter killed her horrible boyfriend.
Isn't it, though? She had it coming, running around with gangsters like that.
I think you're being a little unfair. You can tell she was trying to get away from him by the end. Clearly, she realized she needed to get out and was trying to remove herself from the situation.
I suppose that's true, but she shouldn't have gotten herself into that situation in the first place.
I have to agree with you there.
The date of the inquest approached, and all across the country, people tuned in to watch the legal drama unfold live on TV. Long before OJ, this was the trial of the century.
Giesler had gotten Cheryl excused from testifying, citing the trauma she had already endured.
But that didn't stop the papers from running her picture alongside all the stories.
In every photo, even the ones from the night of the murder, she looks incredibly put together.
A statuesque teenager in cat-eye sunglasses and a ladylike coat.
Just like her mother, there's not a single hair out of place.
She doesn't come across like a crazed teenager or a wild child at all. She looks perfectly prim and proper.
Thanks to Lana.
It is always important to look the part.
And although there were several people testifying, including the autopsy doctor, the police, Stephen Crane, and Mildred Turner, there was only one witness who really mattered.
Lana was the only one who actually saw Cheryl stab Johnny.
The stakes were enormous. The world was watching, and her daughter's fate hung in the balance.
During her 20 years in show business, never had Lana had to perform under so much pressure.
She was about to give the performance of a lifetime, with the cameras rolling live and the nation's eyes watching.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
Now, the story continues.
But before Lana made her grand entrance, the inquest began with another celebrity personality.
Please state your name.
Mickey Cohen.
Your address?
11719 San Vicente Boulevard.
You viewed the remains of the deceased person in this matter?
I reviewed some remains, yes.
Was that somebody you had known in life?
I refused to identify the body.
Did you make a statement that the deceased person was John Stompanato Jr.?
I refuse to identify him as John Stompanato Jr. on the grounds that I may be accused of this murder.
You may be excused.
But wait, didn't Mickey already positively ID the body at the morgue?
Well, he had. But sometime in the week between the stabbing and the inquest, he decided that somehow someone might try to pin the murder on him.
Why even bother to show up at the inquest?
Well, he was probably legally obligated to. But also, as we well know, Mickey relished any opportunity to steal the spotlight.
Well, after Mickey, the autopsy doctor, Chief Anderson, and the on-duty officer who responded to the emergency call took the stand.
Lana appeared in court wearing a sober gray suit, a far cry from the sultry vamp she often portrayed on screen.
As she took the stand, audiences watched with bated breath.
And I said, don't. Don't ever touch me again. I'm absolutely finished. This is the end. And I want you to get out. And after I said that, I was walking towards the bedroom door, and he was right behind me, and I opened it, and my daughter came in. I swear, it was so fast. I truthfully thought she had hit him in the stomach. The best I can remember, they came together and they parted. I still never saw Blade. Mr. Stompanato grabbed himself here.
For the record, the abdomen.
Yes. And he started to move forward, and he almost made a half a turn and then dropped on his back. And when he dropped, his arms went out so that I still did not see that there was blood or a wound until I ran over to him and saw his sweater was cut. And I lifted the sweater up and I saw his wound. I remember only barely hearing my daughter sobbing, and I ran into my bathroom, which is very close. And I grabbed a towel. I didn't know what to do. And then I put the towel there, and Mr. Stompanato was making very dreadful sounds in his throat of gasping, of terrible sounds. And I went to the telephone, and I called my mother because I had been out of the country for so long. I could not remember the doctor's number. And I said, "Mother, quick, call the doctor. Dr. McDonald."
Lana was spectacular. America watched as she gave an emotional retelling of that fateful night. But was it all just the work of an extremely talented actress?
Was she truly distressed, or was she pulling one over on all who watched?
As the inquest was concluding, an unidentified man jumped up from the gallery.
Wait! I need to testify! I need to testify!
Who is that?
Some nutcase.
Lies! All lies! This mother and daughter were both in love with Stompanato. Johnny was a gentleman.
Whether that man was a lunatic, a Cohen plant, or just looking for his 15 minutes of fame was never clear.
My money's on him being a Cohen hire. Always an angle.
The man was escorted away and disappeared in the crowd.
After hearing testimony from all of the witnesses, including Stephen Crane and Lana's mother, Mildred, the jury met for less than half an hour before returning with their verdict.
They ruled that Cheryl had committed a justifiable homicide.
When the verdict was revealed, Mickey Cohen was furious. Of course, he went straight to the press.
It's the first time in my life I've ever seen a dead man convicted of his own murder. So far as that jury's concerned, Johnny just walked too close to that knife.
Cheryl was released from all charges, but custody was granted to her grandmother rather than Lana.
Despite doing everything right, the press and everyone else seemed to think that Lana was a bad mother, and that Cheryl was suffering under her care.
Everyone acted like it was Lana's fault that her daughter ended up being a murderer.
The LA Times was especially brutal.
The day after the inquest, they printed an editorial that found Cheryl blameless, but took Lana to task as a hedonist, whose narrative showed the lack of almost any reference to moral sensitivity in the presence of a child. Cheryl isn't the juvenile delinquent, they wrote, Lana is.
No wonder she was so concerned with keeping up appearances. She was constantly fighting a losing battle with the press.
It does help us see things from Lana's perspective.
Johnny Stompanato's body was sent back to Woodstock, Illinois, where he was given a proper military burial. His living relatives brought a $7 million wrongful death lawsuit against Lana and Stephen Crane, which was settled out of court.
But none of this really answers the question. Who did it? Who really killed Johnny Stompanato? Was it really Cheryl? Or did Lana do it? Or was it a cleverly set up mob hit? Or was it something else entirely?
Although a lot of people have alternate theories about what happened, honestly, I think we already have our answer.
You think it was Cheryl?
I do. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I actually believe what everybody thinks happened is actually what happened.
Well, how can you be so sure?
Well, first of all of the stories agree. There's no conflicting evidence, no shady alibi. No reason to suspect that anything happened other than exactly what was reported. Cheryl Crane killed Johnny Stompanato.
But what about the murder weapon?
It's true that the knife was moved from the site of the stabbing to the bathroom, but there was no attempt to hide it or even clean it.
And I think there weren't any fingerprints on it.
It's not that there were no fingerprints at all, just that there weren't any usable fingerprints. As Chief Anderson reported during the inquest, the blood on the knife was still wet when he arrived on the scene.
Chief Anderson, Was scientific examination made of that knife by your crime lab?
It was.
What were the results of the examination by the crime lab?
There was a smudged fingerprint, but not enough points for identification.
The results were negative. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Anderson also stated that Cheryl openly admitted to having committed the crime right away.
She said that he was threatening her mother. She had gone out in the kitchen and picked up a knife and remained outside the door of the bedroom. And then she rushed into the room. She told me, "I stabbed him. I didn't mean to kill him. I just meant to frighten him." And that was about the sum of the substance of the conversation that I had with Miss Crane.
It's the same story every time.
There's no confusion. There's a perfectly clear motive. If anyone else were going to take the blame, it would be Lana. And both she and the chief of police very clearly stated during the inquest that she had asked to take the blame and was refused.
Sure, but that's just a matter of taking them at their word. What if the chief was on the take from the studios?
No, of course, that's possible, but it just doesn't seem plausible. Remember, at the time, Lana had left MGM. She didn't have the protection of the studio anymore. She was on her own.
Well, what about the theory that Cheryl and Johnny were having an affair?
Well, there just doesn't appear to be any reason to believe anything like that had ever happened.
They could have kept it a secret. And they did seem awfully friendly in those letters.
Well, think of it this way. Cheryl went to boarding school. She and Johnny just didn't spend that much time in each other's company.
But the letters?
Well, the letters are just that. Letters. And that's probably how the majority of their interactions took place.
Additionally, Cheryl freely admitted to having been sexually abused by Lana's previous husband, Lex Barker. If anything had happened between her and Johnny, past evidence leads us to believe she would have spoken out about it.
If anything, it would have helped her alibi if Johnny had been abusing her as well.
Exactly. But most convincing of all, we have Cheryl Crane herself. She admitted her guilt then, and again in an autobiographical tell-all published in the 1980s.
In fact, both Cheryl and Lana published autobiographies detailing the case and have stayed true to their stories all along.
That could be just another cash grab. Like Mickey said, anything to make a buck.
Okay, sure. But what about the years of depression and substance abuse Cheryl experienced following the incident?
What do you mean?
Well, Cheryl Crane, born into a life of extreme wealth, raised by two loving parents.
And a series of nannies.
And her grandmother, was presented with all the opportunities in the world. But she continued to suffer from severe guilt and depression for years following the murder. Does that sound like the behavior of someone with a clear conscience?
That's a pretty broad take. Anyone could tell you that money doesn't buy happiness. And Cheryl was a victim of some pretty horrific abuse at the hands of her mother's previous husband. Her life was hardly perfect.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that Cheryl experienced hardship. But if you consider everything that happened to her, wanting to fight back against an abuser makes perfect sense. She knew what it felt like to be in danger and understood what was at stake. She was willing to do what it took to save her mother's life.
The point of all this is that her actions came at an incredibly high cost. In her adulthood, Cheryl had spoken extensively about the dark period in her life that followed the murder.
Well, it's not something that one just closes a door on, you know. When one is responsible for someone's life ending, whether it's a justifiable act or not, it stays with you. You have to learn to cope with it. You have to learn to accept it for what it was, and it took me many years to do that. I became terribly rebellious, which a lot of teenagers do, but mine was more a series of self-punishments, because no one ever told me. We never discussed what had happened, and so I had no idea what my own parents thought of me, much less what the world thought of me. So naturally, as most children do, they think the worst of themselves. And I did that.
Cheryl blamed herself for being a monster, and the guilt of killing Johnny Stampinato stayed with her for years. It wasn't until much later that anyone suggested her actions might have been brave or heroic.
I don't suppose that kind of guilt is the sort of thing you fake for decades. That's a long time to carry suffering for an act you didn't actually commit.
Yeah, especially since Lana passed away from cancer in 1995. With her gone, there is no one left for Cheryl to protect.
I guess all signs point to the same obvious conclusion. Cheryl may not have meant to kill Johnny Stampinato, but she did.
So whatever happened to Mickey Cohen?
Mickey seemed to lose interest in Lana and Cheryl. After his attempts at blackmail fell through, He moved on from one scheme to the next until he was jailed for tax evasion in 1961. Upon his release in 1972, he went on to become an outspoken advocate for prison reform.
Oh, twist ending.
He continued touring the U.S. and made several television appearances.
I guess some things don't change.
And there you have your Hollywood ending.
And proof that sometimes history does get it right. No secrets, no conspiracy. In this case, the simplest explanation ended up being true.
Don't forget to subscribe to Unsolved Murders on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. Join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network. We thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again. If you liked what you heard, tell your friends. New episodes come out every Tuesday. I'm Wendy McKenzie.
And I'm Carter Roy. We'll see you next time.
If we live till next time.
Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Ron and Max Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro and Jay Silvers, with production assistance by Maggie Admire, and written by Lauren Cannon. Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories stars Carter Roy and Wendy McKenzie. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Mike Capozzi, Alex Daltis, Kimberly Holland, Harris Markson, Sammy Nye, and Steve Pinto.